a better way. You don't have to be.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, November the 7th, 2024. We are up to episode 3,583 of the Survival Podcast, and it is an expert council Q&A show, and it will be the last new show until the week after next, because starting tomorrow, of course, we'll have a flashback because it's Friday. Then Monday through Friday next week, we're going to have all rewinds. Why? TSP 24 happening right here just outside my door. Yep, I will have about 80 TSP freakazoids with me on my property from Wednesday forward, and then it takes time to get ready. I got people coming in early, like my buddy JR, Nicole Awesome Sauce, etc. They get to come in for early festivities, which really is a lot of work in getting ready and prepared and making last minute arrangements. So I just gave up a long time ago trying to run a half-week workshop and do shows on the same week. So that's why that's going to happen. But the good news, as a reminder, starting on Thursday next week, I think the first presentation is at 10 a.m., we will be streaming all the presentations. Now, usually we say all the presentations except the ones that are like outside walk-arounds. We're not really doing any of those this time. I will be doing a morning walk with students Thursday and Friday morning. Between about 8 and 9, just kind of a general walk through parts of the property and some things that, you know, just didn't work here because this place sucks in some ways from a standpoint of there's no reserve battery for moisture here because we only have about between 4 and 10 inches of soil before we hit a rock face that just goes down 1,000 feet. So I'm going to be doing that, so that won't be videoed. I'm sure some students will or something and probably make it available, but the actual presentations, all this great line of presenters, five a day that I have lined up for 3 days, so that's 15 presentations, each of them about 45 minutes in length, stuff all over the place, communication stuff with Jesse Markowitz on Start 9, John Pugliano on the economy, the post-election economy, and what that's going to look like. That should be a great presentation. Some stuff on cooking and food. I'll be doing a presentation on sausage making with a special bonus, at least for MSB members. Now, everybody gets to see the video, but the bonus that I'm going to be announcing is going to become available to you with that class is for MSB members only. It's just a little electronic tool. It's going to be a great event, and those 15... presentations. I think if I charge $99 for people to get those presentations virtually, it'd be a hell of a good deal. It really would. You know what I charge for it? Nothing. They will all be live on my YouTube channel. They will all be archived. All you got to do is make sure that you're subscribed to the YouTube channel and kind of check in. The schedule, I'm going to do a post that'll drop next week about stuff going during the event, and I'll keep it at the top of the blog. So if you want to find the schedule, that's where it will be starting next week, probably Monday it'll be there. All right, with that, what are we going to cover with the expert council today? Dan McAdams and Dr. Paul, they're going to talk to you guys about the election and specifically the relief that many people are feeling due to the results of the election. But they also want to talk about, you know, the need right now. If Trump's going to be able to do any of the things that he's promised, especially from a foreign policy standpoint, the need to keep warmongering neocons the hell out of the cabinet. You know, like, oh, I don't know. Who could they be thinking of, Mike Pompeo? Anyway, I'll tell you why I think it's probably the case that we're not going to keep Mike Pompeo out of the Trump administration. I agree with him. I have much better choices. I'm going to tell you why, not why he's a good pick. And it's a pretty simple answer if you understand some of the simple things about Donald Trump that have been largely ignored, because if we look at simple things about the man, then we see he is just a regular person like everybody else. And, of course, we can't do that when we're trying to make him the reincarnation of Hitler. Jesse Markowitz will talk about understanding the role that relays play when using Noster. The good news is you don't have to be technical to do this. But you do need to be aware of it, and whatever client you're using, basically it's as simple as ticking a bunch of boxes to make sure you have enough connectivity to see all the things that you're going to want to see, and knowing that if one particular relay is handing you stuff you don't want to see, well, you can untick that box. Mike Melito will talk about working with dogs and guns together. And I'm going to have a little bit to say about that from a standpoint of my early experience as a young man with gun dogs that were out hunting game and how we used to do that. And we can contrast our two approaches to it. And I think that both of them work. Doc Bones will talk about dealing with dental fractures. We go to the dentist. What if you can't? What if we're in an apocalyptic situation, whether that be long-term nationally or we're just isolated and cut off and dealing within our groups short-term, like a couple weeks to a month? That's a long time to go with a problem like this. Ken Daniels will talk about why we should start archiving family recipes now, and if you didn't, trying to figure out how to recreate something like Grandma's Chess Pie, because that's what this is about. Ken is going to share his personal recipe for chess pie. And then I have a piece, you know, I keep beating the drum about college dying, the education system dying, the job market totally shifting, and nobody really accepting this. Well, now a Berkeley professor has come out and said most of his students, who, by the way, are 4.0 students, he's talking about a subset of his students, can't find a job. You're coming from Berkeley. You have a 4.0 GPA. Can't find a job. Oh, I know what it is. These are all these idiots at Berkeley that are getting degrees in bitterness studies and gender studies or whatever. You know, the plight of the striped-tailed foofy-flu study, whatever. No. These are people with degrees in computer programming. You go to Berkeley, you spend 4 years and probably $200,000 to get a degree in computer programming from what is considered an elite institution, and you can't get a job. And I know you're thinking, well, maybe they don't want an entry-level job or whatever. Yeah, I can see. This is a problem, though. This is a legit problem, and it's starting to show up where you wouldn't expect it, right? What we've been saying up till now, even me on air, you know, if you're going to go to college, make sure you're getting, like, a STEM degree, you know, or something that is concrete that will get you where you want to go in your career. And if you can't put a concrete, then college is not for you. You're better off with a trade school, a tech school, an apprenticeship, anything. Well, now, like, what's a more STEM-like degree? What is more in science, technology, engineering, math than computer science? What's going on? The guy that is behind it, the professor, he's sort of there. But there's something really being missed here. There's something really being missed here. I wonder what it could be. Well, Jack will tell you, because that will be my anchor segment. With that, real quick, I don't have an item of the day for you today. I do want to let you know, though, that the item that I ran all week, and I'm just going to stick with, is the Gigator Weed Flame Torch. That thing is awesome. I've been using it a lot this week to get certain things cleaned up and dealt with in property prep and stuff like that. It's just an awesome tool. It's $40. If you've been looking for a good weed flame torch, whether it's for flaming back weed growth, whether it's for termination of cover crops because you've taken my cover crop course, whether it's just because you like to burn stuff, because, hey, we all know burning stuff is fun. You just want the power. I feel the power of 1.8 million BTUs of energy. For any reason, if you're looking for a good flame torch, this guy is the way to go. The write-up also has a video that shows it in operation. And one of the really cool uses for a torch like this that I think many people don't even really think about is if you're a person that uses weed-blocking fabric in your gardening or your landscaping or whatever, they're the perfect tool. You lay down your weed blocker where you want it. You mark where you want your plants. You heat up your torch. And then you just take the bell of the torch. You're not using flame to do this. You just take the bell of the torch and you melt a hole wherever you want to put a plant. It makes the perfect size hole to drop transplants into. I use red Solo cups for my transplant cups. I fill them up about an inch from the top, and they fit in that hole like a glove. And because it's melted through, it causes all of the edges to sear, to basically melt, and then cool off. And then that way, you don't get any microplastic residue, you don't get any fraying and running. It's the perfect way to do it. And I learned that, by the way, back when he was still spin farming from Curtis Stone. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and dig on into it and start off with hearing about, you know, the need to keep the warmongering neocons out of the Orange Man cabinet. And I'll tell you why I don't think it's going to happen, but there might be some mitigation, and they'll talk about that too in regards to the fact that one man who has Trump's ear is Elon Musk. And what did Elon Musk say about this? I'll let Dan and Ron tell you about it.
Yeah, it does feel like there's just a sense of relief in the country. Maybe it's just my own personal feeling, like, oh, I'm glad this nightmare is over, because, you know, the Biden-Harris administration has been so bad on every level, economics, foreign policy, civil liberties, you know, free expression. They've just been terrible all along. And you're right, we don't have any illusions that we're going to wake up in Never Never Land or what have you. But there is that feeling of relief. The other impression I had a feeling that the threat of unrest was overblown. I really sort of had a feeling that this would be a calm, going back to a normal night where you see who wins at the end of the evening. And that was the pleasant surprise for me. I thought it might happen, and I was glad to see it happen. I was glad to sit there, look at the numbers, and say, okay, I can go to bed. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow morning and Biden's going to be president again.
I guess it would have been an overwhelming task for the losers to say, oh, Trump stole the votes.
Yeah.
A little bit too many votes to have stolen.
Yeah. Well, I had a couple clips just for fun, just to show kind of where our heads have been. It's been a great week for the show, and we're grateful that people that have watched us. And we haven't had a huge bump on Rumble, but we had a huge bump on Twitter X, which makes us happy. So let's put a couple things on. Now, remember yesterday we did a warning show. Trump, please stay away from Pompeo. He's a bad dude. Here is what we said. This is the show itself uploaded onto Twitter X. And I said, Trump told Rogan what a mistake it was to hire John Bolton last time around, but he's in danger of making an even worse mistake with Mike Pompeo. Beware of the neocons, President Trump. And go to the next one. This is funny. We had an interesting response to this show that we put up. Elon Musk. He said, I agree that we should not empower neocon warmongers. He replied to our show. And you said, thanks, Elon. I'm glad we agree. When the smoke clears, we'd love to have you on the Liver Report. And to our real surprise, he said, sure.
Do you think that was the real Elon Musk?
It kind of seems like, unless someone hacked him.
Wow, they'd be in trouble.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
But that was fun, and it was a lot of fun. And in fact, even just doing the show and having him respond made the news. If you go to the next one, this was a tweet from Leading Report saying, breaking, Ron Paul tells Trump to be wary of neocons like Mike Pompeo, who are, quote, yet again infesting his cabinet and administration. That was pretty fun. And one final thing is the show itself. Go to the next one on Twitter that we put up, the Neocon show, the Beware of Neocons. If you look down there on the bottom right, 3.1 million views of our show, Dr. Paul. I know that makes you happy.
Yes, it's good. It surprises me. Yeah. You know, I'm amazed when a crowd turns up, and I figure the message is getting out.
Now, again, understanding that I am certainly not advocating to put Mike Pompeo in the position of Secretary of State or in any way directly dealing with foreign policy, because I do believe Pompeo is a warmonger, and he is a neocon. He may not be the worst of the warmongers, and he may not be the worst of the neocons. And respectfully, I disagree with Dan that Pompeo is a bigger mistake than Bolton. Pompeo is a big mistake. Bolton would start a fucking war with the Girl Scouts of America if they bought an island off the coast of Florida and said that they were an independent nation, but they plan to leave everybody alone. He would want to invade it the next second. He is the most bloodthirsty mustache neocon that's ever existed on planet Earth. Pompeo's almost as bad. It might be the case that Dan's right, though, and he is a bigger mistake because he doesn't look as bad, so he might get away with more. I don't know. Maybe I've missed that one. But, yeah, I think Bolton is worse. Now, why do I think Trump will use Pompeo? I think that Trump values one thing in people above all other things, unfortunately, including competence, and that is loyalty. And Pompeo has been a loyal Trump ally and has not wavered in the least. I'm not praising him for that. I'm stating it as fact. You can't find me where he has been disloyal to the Orange Man. And so I think the Orange Man will say, well, he can do the job, he wants the job, and I know he'll be loyal to me. And I think that will, and I think this is something that I actually share in common with Trump. People that I really view as friends, people that I really view as loyal, I will be loyal to them back. The way my old business partner Neil put it was, Jack, you're loyal to a fault. So I can only pick on him so much, but I really hope somebody either gets through to him or at least says, if you're going to use this man this way, then there must be a leash and a shock collar on him. And a bad boy, and jerked back hard, and then sprayed with a water bottle in the face and zapped a little bit. Like, he he's kind of like that. Like, he could be useful in that position because your adversarial nations will have respect for him in that. But if he doesn't have a really good system of checks on him, he could be an architect that gets us into some things that we really don't need to get into that I don't believe Trump wants. And this is why I wish Trump would not allow his loyalty to cloud his judgment, because this man is not in line with what Trump says he wants. He's not. And I don't think anybody should be under any illusions to the contrary. But the other side of it is, it's going to be what it's going to be, and there will be neocons in the Trump government, because they are like leeches. They are like parasites. They're like ants. They're like, well, you know what? That's all wrong. They are cockroaches. No matter how hard you try to keep them out, they'll get inside and they'll breed and they'll make more cockroaches. Let's hear from Jesse Markowitz on a Noster question.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I have a question on Noster. The question is, why can't my friends see all the posts I've made with Noster? Details. I just got started with Noster and made a bunch of posts using the web client Primal.net. I sent my NPub to my friend who searched for my posts using his iOS app, Damus. He couldn't find any posts at all. Do we have to use the same client for this to work? Here's the quick answer. You and your friend can use different clients, but you must make sure that you and your friend have at least some of the same relays. They don't need to all be the same, but you have to share at least one relay for them to see what you have posted. For those less familiar with Noster, I'll dive a bit deeper. The big tech platforms like YouTube, Twitter, X, and Facebook are all owned by companies with large centralized data stores. If you post publicly on that platform, anyone, everyone on that platform can see your post. The flip side is, if they don't like what you post, they can limit the reach of your post, delete it, or delete your account entirely. Noster is different. It's a protocol, not a platform, so there is no company that owns it or runs it. Anyone can build software using the protocol, and all the different software programs can work together. Noster is an abbreviation for notes and other stuff transmitted by relays, N-O-S-T-R. It is a protocol for sharing notes and other stuff. Most of the initial client interfaces were designed to be like Twitter for posting notes, but there are many other interesting use cases being tried out as well. Regardless of the particular use case, the client you use allows you to read and write notes and other stuff. These are stored on relays, basically just servers that store all the data. Just like anyone can create their own client and users can use any client, relay software can also be written by anyone, and anyone who wants to run a relay can do so. You don't need anyone's approval. Different clients have different interfaces, but almost all of them will allow you to view which relays you're currently writing to and reading from, and allow you to add relays that you want to read and write to. When you post something with your client, the client writes it to your selected relays. When you read posts with your client, it reads from your relays. Some clients allow you to selectively read or write from only some of your configured relays. So, if you post to relays A, B, and C, and your friend is only reading from relays X, Y, and Z, they will never see your posts. If you post to a half a dozen or so popular relays, it's very likely that most folks will be able to find your posts. If you follow someone, many clients will be able to tell you which relays that person uses. But you still need to have at least some overlap for it to work. There are a large number of relays. Some are free to use, some require payment. Some are publicly accessible, others are private. For example, I run a private relay on my Start9 server. Right now, I'm using it just as an experiment to archive my posts. But I'm also considering using it for some private group messaging where it's restricted only to my particular group. While I'm discussing Nostr, let me point out two other key things. First, one of the best parts about Nostr is that you can own your own identity and content. Unlike the big platform websites where they need to approve your account and the username you want to use, on Nostr, you generate your own user ID and password. The user ID is generally called an NPUB, and the password is generally called an NSEC. This is for a Nostr public key, Nostr secret key. These are technically, it's a public-private key pair. But if you think about it basically as a user ID password, that's basically fine. It works for most people. It's generally right. The one differential on it is this. Unlike a regular user ID password combination, you cannot change your password. Once you've generated this pair, it is permanent. Now, the good news is no one can take it away from you. If you post something, it gets digitally signed with your private key, and anyone can validate it by using your public key, your user ID. Further, folks can encrypt messages to you with your public key, and only you can decrypt them using your private key, your NSEC. Second, Nostr protocol is still very early. Protocol changes are still being made, and not every client supports every part of the protocol. If you're doing normal posts and reads, you should be fine across everything, but there are some special cases. For example, for some direct messages, the client HexChat supports gift-wrapped direct messages. It's a special way of saying direct messages designed to reduce the amount of public information about who is DMing who. If everyone uses the same client, it all works great. If you use a different client that doesn't support this, it's possible you may not see the messages as you would otherwise expect. If you want to try out HexChat, go to 0xchat.com and download the client, iOS and Android, and then search for the Survival Podcast Community group there. If you have any more questions, Bitcoin, Lightning, self-hosting, Nostr, other technology questions, please send them in to Jack, and I'm happy to answer them all. Thank you.
Good folks, or good folks, good stuff there from Jesse. And reminder, Jesse's going to be doing a complete walkthrough through the installation and use of a Start9 server at TSP 24. And again, we will be live streaming all those videos, so that will be made available to you if you want to know more. Next up, let's hear from Mike Melito on guns and dogs working together.
Guns and dogs go together like peanut butter and jelly, at least to me. Hey TSP, Mike Melito here. Happy to be back on a TSP Expert Council show. On my dogs and gun background, I grew up an avid hunter. The family raised rabbit dogs. One of my good friends raised black and tan coonhounds. When I was the commander of a tactical team to stop active shooters, I was in charge of a lot of armed guys. I was also in charge and manager of a canine section of quite a few men that ran about an even mix of German Shepherds and Belgian Malinois. And in times past, I ran Akitas, and I now currently have Rhodesian Ridgebacks. An outstanding breed if you want both hunting and protection. Just a little bit on my background there with dogs and guns. Let's start in the beginning, choosing a puppy. I mean, you are choosing from a litter. In addition to many other things you might want to do when looking for a puppy for temperament, you may want to make a loud noise, like a clap. See how the puppies respond. If you are choosing specifically a gun dog or a dog to be around guns, one that does not run and hide or literally pee, one that is curious is good, one that is indifferent is good, and one that after you've clapped several times, it's like, okay, what else? That's a pretty good indication that that's going to be a good gun dog. Not saying you can't work with other dogs, just saying if you have a pick, you're picking out of a litter, that's a pretty good thing to look for. And as far as with your puppy or dog, depending on when you get them, getting them used to guns. Probably the first time they're exposed to a gun shouldn't be when you're out in the field and you fire a round off. That could go any number of different ways. Something that your dog likes, probably going for a walk. Well, get out somewhere where you can go for a walk with a gun. With a shotgun, with a rifle, with just your handgun. You EDC, this will be easier, because if you everyday carry your concealed carry gun, then they're probably used to the smell and things of a gun. Just walking, just going on a trail walk with a gun, so they see it in your hand, they get used to it, before you ever shoot it. Just you walking with a gun, and them getting used to that environment, walking in the woods, in the field, around the farm field, with a gun. If you're more into the tactical side of stuff, dry firing in the house with the gun and having them around and just getting used to it. Getting used to you handling the gun, shouldering the gun, and it just becomes something that they're used to. Next, going shooting, going to the range. Like you would do with a child, don't start off some crazy loud thing. You may get started with a .22, maybe even a .22 firing calibres, CB caps, shorts, .22 long rifle. Guns are louder, I encourage you to wear hearing protection, but some guns are much louder than others. Just getting them used to being around shooting. Maybe just having them in the truck with the windows partially rolled down. And then when you shoot, going back and encouraging them and making it a good experience for them. Letting them know that it's a good thing that they're out and you guys are shooting. It's a good time. Sure, it's not all just about you shooting. Take them out, let them walk around, let them sniff stuff. Give them treats when they're around you and the guns. Maybe unleashed or without being in the truck, fire a couple of rounds. See the dog's reaction. Hopefully everything will be fine. Lots of encouragement, depending on what your dog's love language is, treats, verbal affirmation, physical touch, right? Whatever your dog's into, make sure it's a pleasant, rewarding experience. Don't overdo it, and just incrementally build them into it. The next thing is have realistic expectations. I'm a big fan of choosing a breed for what you want. You know, don't get a Chihuahua and expect it to retrieve ducks for you. It's probably not going to work out well, to take it to the extreme. But hunting and tactical use of dogs is probably outside the scope of this. Some good tips for getting your dogs used to guns. And again, it may not even be an issue. They may just not even care. It may not bother them at all. But just some good helpful tips that I've seen over the years you may want to employ. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
Great segment. A couple quick add-ons there. Number one is, I'm all about, you know, making a loud noise and seeing if the dog is just predisposed to just being terrified of loud noises. But that can go the wrong direction. So when I was a kid and I was learning how to train bird dogs, I had a great uncle named Pete. And he actually bred and sold started hunting dogs, kind of general purpose dogs, his go-to, and it's why my dog of choice and also my other uncles and all, we really liked Brittany's. Brittany Spaniels were kind of a do-it-all. In fact, the Brittany, if you're looking for a hunting dog that's versatile, probably the most versatile dog in the world. They're from, of course, Brittany, the region of France is where they get their name. But they were the classic poacher's dog of the time. When the king owned all the land, you needed a dog that could hunt ducks one day, pheasants the next, etc., rabbits after that. Like, they are the do-it-all dog if you train them properly. So when I decided I was going to do this as a kid, the first person I talked to was my great-uncle Pete. Well, he told me that what he did with his dogs is he would get all the dogs weaned a couple weeks after they were weaned, and that's when he decided who he was going to invest in and who he wasn't. He'd take them all out together and fire a 12-gauge in the air. The ones that ran away, he sold them for less money as just puppies. Do what you want with them. The other ones he would work with until they had basic commands, they knew what pointing was, they had, you know, they're well started, but they weren't complete, and that's when he would sell them off. And he never wanted to, like, completely develop a dog and sell it, because he said, one, he has too much of a relationship. I understand this, too. A part of why I love the man. He said he had too much of a relationship with the dog if he had it that long. And he also wanted it to have a very strong bond with its new owner, so he didn't want to be the bond. And so I got both of those. But when I told my grandfather this, he goes, that dumb son of a bitch, he don't know nothing. And then he goes, well, he knows a lot of things, but a lot of things he thinks he knows, he doesn't know. And I asked him what he meant. He said, let me tell you, the best dog I ever had, I got from him. He didn't even want it because it ran away. And I'm not saying to pick the dog that runs away, but this was my grandfather did a lot of what Mike talked about at the end. You take this pup out, and you start firing like 22 shorts. And when a dog reacts, you have somebody hold the dog on a leash. And when a dog reacts, you don't do anything. Because if you like pet it, love on it, whatever, you're just the same thing you learn from Joel all the time, right? You're reinforcing a negative behavior. So once the dog goes calm, then you pet the dog. And you do it again. And it doesn't take long, and the dog just goes, well, whatever the hell that is. Like, they're not worried about it, so I'm not worried about it. Now, to me, and this is what's worked the best for me with getting dogs really conditioned with guns, teach them what the gun does. The gun makes things dead. So what we would do is we'd take that young pup out, and we'd pop something you could shoot, like a blackbird or a squirrel. In Pennsylvania, they're actually game animals, so you weren't supposed to shoot them. Sometimes maybe, like we're eating squirrel tonight. And when they understand that the boomstick makes the thing with the bushy tail in the tree dead and come down, they start to get excited about that more so than just being like excited about hunting. The boomstick makes the bushy tail dead, right? This gets into canine brain really fast. It also is what helped me solve the final portion of the problem that I had with Charlie. Charlie was a pit pointer mix, so he did have some bird dog in him. I don't really get to do any bird hunting. I didn't want to put the effort into training him to be a true gun dog. Like, he's not really... Pit mix, great dog. Not great for that app. Like Mike said, get the dog that fits the goal. You know, you don't want a chihuahua for hunting geese. but he was never afraid of the gun. He wanted to kill it. He wanted to eat it. He wanted to go after anything that made a sound that he didn't like. Right? So I would do a lot of airsoft training with him, and I'd have some. And what got him off of it being all the time 100% was shot collar, right? And I think Charlie got shocked his whole dog life of 11 and a half years three times. What he got was the vibrate, because once they learn what the shock does, they're like, I don't want this. He didn't even have to have a collar on. I'd show him something that looked like a remote control. He's like, oh, okay, I got it, boss, right? It was like a reinforcement training. But we would do that with him, and it was almost perfect until the first time I shot a squirrel out of the tree. And I think I did that with a pellet gun. And then the dog, you could see the dog brain click. Oh, that's what that thing does. So when he gets that out, we're going to go get something that I get to eat a piece of. And once he had that, he didn't give a shit about guns, except when you pick a gun up, he's like, are you going to go out there and knock cans over, or are we doing something, Dad? And so I think the earliest you can associate, especially a dog that's going to be a hunting dog, with the boomstick makes things dead. Once they know that, here's the one problem with a gun dog. This is the problem you're going to always have with a gun dog. If you pick that gun up, he doesn't understand. I'm just going to the range. I'm dropping it off at the gunsmith, whatever. And a lot of times, like my dog, my Brittany, it didn't even matter if he saw a gun. If a bunch of people got up early in the morning and got in the vehicle and left, they must be hunting. That's how we hunt. He would be pissy about it. He would be upset about it. When you came home, he looked at you like, eat shit, you went without me. Same thing with like archery season, deer season. He doesn't understand the difference. So one of the things I did try to do with him is when we did have things that involved guns, at least, where he wasn't going to go, is we would put those guns either like out in the shanty where they were secure or locked in a case in the vehicle before the next morning. And that way, when you just walked out and left, for all he knows, you're going to work or whatever. Because, believe me, dogs, once they make the association, boomstick hunt, when they see the boomstick, it amazes me that some people think that we abuse dogs when we give them jobs like this. Every hunting dog, dedicated hunting dog I had, was never happier. Never happier than when he was in the field doing his job. The absolute glory of that dog's life was going out there and chasing pheasants or grouse or wood ducks or what have you. So, a little longer than I expected. Let's hear about dental fractures in a grid-down scenario where you're the only medic.
Hi, Joe Walton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the website doomandbloom.net, and co-author of the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, plus designer of an entire line of medical kits specially made for the off-grid medic. A survival group needs someone with medical knowledge and supplies to treat orthopedic injuries and bleeding wounds. These are serious issues, and indeed, the average survival medical kit concentrates on these issues to the exclusion of much else. Even well-prepared medics, however, don't realize they'll be faced with quite a different challenge much more often, dental problems. Injuries or oral health issues can negatively affect the work efficiency of members of your group. If you've ever had to work with a bad toothache, you know exactly what I mean. Today we're going to discuss how to deal with dental trauma, specifically broken teeth, in survival settings. First and foremost, the group medic needs to know dental anatomy. Luckily, a tooth is a relatively simple structure. The part of the tooth that you see above the gum line is called the crown. Hidden below the crown is the root, which resides in a bony jaw socket known as the alveolus. Teeth are anchored to alveolar bone with ligaments, just like you have ligaments holding together your knee or shoulder. Different materials comprise the tooth. The enamel is the hard external white covering of the tooth crown. Essentially, it's the tooth's armor. Dentin is a firm yellowish material composed of many microscopic tubes underneath the enamel. When enamel is lost, heat or cold travels through these tubes to cause pain. And the pulp. The pulp is the softer tissue in the center surrounded by the dentin. The pulp contains blood vessels and nerve endings and is considered the living part of the tooth. When the nerve dies, the tooth dies. A normal adult mouth has 32 teeth, most of which replace baby teeth by age 13. 8 incisors, the middlemost 4 teeth and the upper and lower jaws, 4 canines, the pointed teeth just outside the incisors, premolars, 8 of them total, teeth between the canines and the molars, and molars, flat teeth in the rear of the mouth. There are 8 of them total. Now, there are also 4 wisdom teeth, or third molars, and these are teeth that arrive later, probably around age 18. They're often surgically removed to prevent displacement of other teeth. Different teeth have different purposes. Incisors and canines are for cutting, while molars are for grinding. Let's talk about dental trauma. Dental trauma can appear in various forms. After an injury to the oral cavity, a person may have a dental fracture, a portion of a tooth chipped or broken off, a dental subluxation, a loose tooth, or a dental avulsion, a tooth that's knocked out completely. We're going to talk about dental fractures today. When a portion of the tooth is broken off, its categorization is based on the number of layers of the tooth that are exposed. Traditionally, dentists have referred to these as Ellis class 1, 2, and 3 fractures. In an LS1 fracture, only the enamel has been broken and no dentin or pulp is exposed. This is a problem only if there is a sharp edge to the tooth. You can consider filing the edge smooth in some cases. An LS2 fracture shows yellow or beige dentin under the enamel. This area may be sensitive and should be covered if possible. The composition of dentin is more porous than enamel and allows bacteria to enter and infect the tooth. And then there are LS3 fractures. Here the pulp and dentin are both exposed. LS3 fractures can be quite uncomfortable. If the pulp is exposed, there may also be some bleeding. The risk of permanent damage is likely, so protective coverings are very important here. So how to go about treating dental fractures? Be aware that the methods that I'm discussing here are temporary measures which very well may require reapplication at one point or another. When you identify a fracture of a tooth due to external trauma, you should, of course, evaluate the patient for associated damage to the face, including the tongue, the jaw, and the inside of the cheek. On occasion, a soft tissue laceration is found and must be sutured. In this case, you would use an absorbable suture like plain catgut, PDS, or polyglycolic acid. You would want to use water to thoroughly flush and rinse the inside of the mouth for easier evaluation. For your own protection, you want to place a bite block. Even a large grade school pink eraser or two will do, but you definitely don't want to get bitten. Using your gloved hand or a cotton applicator, you want to lightly touch that injured tooth to see if it's loose. For LS2 fractures of dentin, you want to dry the exposed surface and cover it with temporary cement. You can improvise a mixture of oil of cloves, also known as eugenol, and zinc oxide powder to make a protective covering. Improvisations for austere settings include a fluoride dental varnish, clear nail polish, or even a cyanoacrylate superglue to decrease sensitivity. Provide something for pain, like Advil, let's say, and Colpax to reduce swelling. A thin cloth should be placed, by the way, between the pack and the skin. You want to, of course, avoid hot and cold food or drink for a while, so make sure you instruct the patient to do so. Now, LS3 fractures into pulp, they're more problematic, partially because of the high risk of infection. Calcium hydroxide, also known as DICAL, D-Y-C-A-L, If you place it on the pulp surface, coupled with additional temporary cement, that might be able to be used as a protective covering. Newer prescription materials, known as glass ionomers, are added in modern dentistry. Alternatively, a commercially available product from India known as Prevest, P-R-E-V-E-S-T, Fusion Flow, F-L-O, is a composite material that may be useful, but it has to be cured with a UV dental curing light to harden. These are available online and can be battery operated. When the pulp is involved in the fracture, antibiotics may also be appropriate. Penicillin 500 mg orally every 6 hours or doxycycline 100 mg orally twice a day for a week, these are acceptable options. Particularly difficult dental fractures involve the root. Sometimes it's not until the gum is peeled back that the damage to the root is exposed and identified. If this is the case off-grid, the tooth is likely unsalvageable, especially in vertical fractures. In this situation, the tooth should probably be extracted. I'll talk about how to do that in the near future. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, check out our one-of-a-kind survival dental kit or any of the other quality kits in our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Next up, I've got a segment from Ken Daniels. We had somebody write in and said that his mother or grandmother, I think his mother, had a recipe for chest pie that was just awesome. And that recipe apparently died when she did, and he's trying to recreate it. And how could he approach that? So Ken will obviously give you some information on that. But he also talks here about making sure that these things aren't lost. And I'm going to tell you a story about my family when this segment's over that reinforces it and says, get it done now. Don't wait.
Hello. This week's question comes from Mark. I've been trying to recreate my late grandmother's recipe for chess pie. I don't come across chess pie often, but none seem to be like my grandma's. Is there a best way to try to recreate this memory from my childhood? Thanks, Mark. This question is a difficult one to answer, but I'm going to give several points of view for advice. Chess pie is a regional-style pie found in the Midwest and southern states. I've also seen it as east as Virginia and Maryland. Each region has its own style and common recipes based on the culture of the immigrants living in the area. This really is the history of the people and food in the U.S. I'll leave my recipe for chess pie if anyone wants to try and make for themselves. It actually does make a really good pie for Thanksgiving. All right, Mark. So first, I'd start with where your grandmother lived in the U.S. I'd research some recipes in this area online. If your family migrated from the East Coast to the Midwest, the recipe can actually be a hybrid of these styles. Find some recipes and make some. Get the kids involved. This is a good time to share memories of you and your grandmother. Another option is researching recipe books during your grandmother's lifetime. If she left some of her books, seeing if there's a print recipe of chess pie anywhere helps. As much as I'd love to think that my own grandmother is a culinary innovator, most of her recipes were from Good Housekeeping or Betty Crocker or some variation thereof. I've even found handwritten notes and newspaper clippings used as bookmarks that are gold to find even in books that aren't recipe books. Recipes were often verbally shared too. I know my grandmother had this recipe swap exchange club with her church group. Ladies gathered all around and shared recipes that they liked. I actually found my grandmother's pound cake recipe from one of her church friends. It was a wonderful find. If she has any living family members her age or has living neighbors or friends, they share recipes like baseball cards. And even if you may not find hers, you may find one close to her style. And if you find some clues or alternative recipes, again, get the family and make these new pies. See what you like and see what you didn't like. Write all this information down, but more on this in a bit. Lastly, while it's sad that this recipe could be lost, sometimes the memory of the food can be so much more emotional. You may have tried the same pie, but it will never live up to her chess pie. Now, we get to the heart of why I took this question. One of your family's greatest histories and legacies is in the recipes you eat every day. It's becoming more uncommon to have contemporary family recipes. But as homesteaders, we should be cooking at home more instead of getting processed store-bought food. Jumping online and finding a quick recipe on Google has its ease, but we should be writing down our favorites, how we changed it with different ingredients or cooking styles, noting when we made mistakes. Just because they came from online does not mean that you cannot make it your own. If you found out your favorite chess pie came from the back of a Crisco can, would it diminish the memory of your grandma or the pie? What I wouldn't give to have my grandma's old index cards that were dirty and dusted with flour, all of her hand-scribbled notes about variations about what worked and what didn't work. I think of my grandma's chicken and dumplings, and as a chef, I've tried from all of those times helping her. I just don't seem to get it right. Maybe trying over and over and over keeps her memory alive. When I was 15, my grandmother passed away. I helped her cook begrudgingly at the time. Now I wish I had cared more. How would I have known I wanted those recipes all those years ago? Archiving what you are cooking and keeping them safe is just as important as family heirlooms. Our history and best memories are in what we eat and drink. I believe I recall Jack talking about his grandmother's chow chow and how much he misses it. I remember an old traditional eggnog recipe my grandmother had that no one remembers. These recipes are priceless. Mark, I urge you to start writing down your recipes that you make now. Here's how I do this. I started with index cards a while ago, and I feel it was a great option. I just felt there was a more modern solution. I use this system called LiveScribe. It's a digital pen and dot matrix paper that you can write on. I'm not an affiliate and I do not get paid for any of that. In fact, I don't even know if you can even buy it anymore. It's kind of an old tech. You might be able to get it on eBay, but for me, it's something that I go to time and time again. It works and I love it. With this system, I can write my recipes, variation, notes on what works and what didn't work by hand, and it digitally records at the same time. So I've got both my actual notebook and a digital copy that's uploaded all at once. I can even come back to the page years later on that same notebook, write with my LiveScribe pen, and it will update the digital copy. I may make the same dish over and over as a chef, but I try to pull the notebook and write any notes and dates when I change ingredients, brands, or technique. It helps me remember and improve dishes with the secondary benefit of archiving for my family or for future chefs. There will be countless ways to archive your family recipes. You need to find your own, but do it. My recipes are actually in my will. Copies are to be given to numerous family members and friends. Again, as a chef, mixologist, I hope that this is a part of my legacy, or at least it will save someone countless of hours of mistakes by learning from mine. Mark, I wish you the best in this search. I am always available if you have more information like her age and history. I do a fair amount of food and beverage history, and we can get pretty close to her style if with a little more info. All I ask in return is to start your own archive of your family recipes. It's something we rarely think about, but as you know now, it's very important. And for those that have messaged me, yes, drinkeatlearn.com is down for maintenance. We're rebuilding the site in response to some suggestions. Should be back up soon. But until next time, this is Ken with drinkeatlearn.com. Cheers.
So I want to tell you about something that's true about my family. It's not the biggest loss in the world to me, but there are a couple recipes that I don't have that I wish I did. I don't know that I would make them very often, but it would be nice to make pierogies the way that my grandmother did, for instance. That would be one of them. As many of you know, and I don't go deep into it because I'm not one for looking for a pity party, but my childhood had some really good things in it, but overall it sucked. My family sucks. And so most of the time, if you hear me talk about my family, and I use those words and I sound like I'm happy about it, I'm talking about literally the side of the family that I married into. Right, my sisters, my father, my uncles, and, you know, the best people in my family are unfortunately gone. And even some of the not-so-good ones are also gone. So just understand that that's the case with this. But I'll also tell you that there was a time when I didn't think that about my family, even though it was already true because I was a kid. And you never know what's going to happen. So with that in mind, I want you to know that I think if you have things like this, like your grandmother cooks something and it's really special or whatever, that it's important to archive those things for the family. And I think if you have like that grandmother or that, you know, great grandma or whoever that like, I'm keeping this until I die, maybe explain to them that if you want this to live on, then somebody has to know how to do it. And it shouldn't be one person. It should be the family. I don't really understand people that, like, it's my secret recipe or some shit like that, and or I happen to have one family member on this side of things who's, I don't really care for this person's mother because she has this way that she makes eggs and she doesn't want to tell the other person how to do it because this person is like a controller and she wants to have control in that way. And I'm the only one who can make this. All of these things are stupid. All of these things are making mistakes. The stuff that's in your family culinarily, I do believe, should be preserved. And here's my family's loss of that and how it happened. My uncle on my father's side, his younger brother, was kind of a dirtbag, and so much so that the lady that he ended up with for the rest of his rest of her life anyway, was his best friend from high school's wife. who had a child, and she never talked to this kid. That's just to, she didn't talk to her own kid. Just to give you the level of person we're talking about here. Well, when I was working for Fluke and we were living in Pennsylvania, I, you know, got the opportunity to at least go see my father once in a while, and my uncle lived across the street from him with this woman. And my eldest uncle, Michael, had asked for the recipes for things like lasagna and stuff like that from his mom, and she said, I have them and I'm not giving them to anybody. You know, this was a tenuous situation, and I didn't want to make it any worse. So I should have said something along the lines of, listen, bitch, these are not yours, and maybe use some even more vulgar words there. But I didn't. I held myself, and I'm like, I don't really care about this that much. And she ended up dead of a drug overdose. About 5 years later, this brother of my dad's, my uncle, having all of his own issues, ended up blowing his own brains out, and wherever that stuff was, it is gone for all time. It's never coming back. In any event, my grandmother was an amazing woman, and one of the things that really brought the family together, as fractured as it was her Sunday dinners and the food that she cooked. And those particular recipes are lost to history forever, and they cannot be recreated. And while maybe one or two did come from, you know, a Home and Garden magazine or something, the majority of the recipes she had came to her from her mother and came to us from Ukraine. And those are gone now. And I think that's a terrible thing to lose, especially in a day and age where you can store all this information on a little tiny card the size of a postage stamp. It is so easy to do today, and I think that for some of you that maybe, like, you don't have the crappy relationship with your family that I do, but maybe you're not as close as you want to be to your mom or your grandmother or your father or your father-in-law or your grandfather. It is a very rare person that does that bullshit of, I don't want to give anybody that. Like, most people, especially as they get older, if you say, will you teach me how to make, would be in love with that idea. They would love to hand down what they know and know that it will be there after they're gone and be something that they can be remembered by. I don't think it's going too far. Honestly, I think everybody, because food is such a uniting thing and it's so universal, to have a family cookbook, to have all members of the family that are able to produce things that everybody loves, share how to do that. This secret recipe shit is nonsense, all right? Let's move on from there. I'm going to move on into my segment now. Well, as you guys know, I've been kind of beating on the education system for a long time, and I'm sure some of you are like, Jack, we get it. But I don't know that you do. I don't know that you get it. And I'm not going to stop because you are either going to be directly hit by all of these economic and shifts in labor and resources and needs and educational background and all of it, technology shifts, you're either going to get hit by it directly or indirectly in that your kids or younger people in your life, one way or another you care about, are definitely going to get hit by it. And the younger you are right now, the more likely this is the case, including the person who's 26 years old with a good job. That, you know, came out of school, got the good job, everything seems to be going well, I'll be fine, nothing's going to go wrong. You know, whenever I hear stories like that, I think about places where not, you know, just not a sector died, but a whole town died. There's a town, I don't know what it's called in Arkansas. It's about halfway between Memphis, Tennessee, and Little Rock on I-40. Is that 40? Yeah, that's I-40. And it's a place that I've had to stay a few times because if you're on your way back from Tennessee because you're at Nicole Sauce's or John Willis's and you're ready for a hotel room and you don't get one there, you're not getting one until you get to Little Rock because there ain't nothing in between. And this town, When I was got there, the first time I ended up stuck there with a buddy of mine named David, and we drove around a little bit to see what was there when we were finding a hotel to stay in, and we found this area that was like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of square foot of warehouses. I mean, it was just warehouse after warehouse after warehouse after warehouse, rusted, disheveled, destroyed, crippled. Like, you could look at this and go, this used to be something. And for a town of this size, it was everything, and it was all gone. And it was about 7 years later that I ended up in this town again at a little bar at a hotel, and I talked to a gentleman who told me how the town used to be. And this would be going back into the 70s. And it was a great blue-collar town, and it all went away. If a whole town can go away, your job can go away, your company can go away. I guarantee if you were working for Enron in 1999, you thought you were going to retire there if you'd been there long enough. How'd that work out? So just take the warning that I'm giving you here with, you know, some reality along with it. So somebody, one of you guys sent me an email about a UC Berkeley computer science professor named James O'Brien. And he goes through this. He highlights the challenges faced by top performing graduates in getting a job. And here's like 10 key points from the article instead of reading the article to you because it's very long and it's good. It's just really deep into data, more than you're going to care about. But there's a decline in job offers for graduates. Even outstanding graduates with 4.0 GPAs from this guy's, you know, class, this guy sounds like a good professor that actually like stays in touch with his students after they leave. He said there's a lot of them that are getting no offers at all. UC Berkeley degree in computer science, no degree off in degree and no offers at all as a 4.0 student. And he says this is not just a downturn. This is like a significant shift from the previous trend. This guy's used to seeing his students that have high grades go out, and maybe they don't start at the top, but, man, they have no trouble getting started. He also says the difficulty in securing employment is part of a broader irreversible trend, is the word that's used in this article, over and over and over again. And this is not temporary. And this is a guy that probably, you know, I give academics a hard time, but if you're teaching computer science at UC Berkeley, you're probably pretty good, okay, at what you do. You're probably pretty smart. The impact on future graduates is current college students may face limited job opportunities upon graduation, and that indicates, according to this guy, a need for proactive measures. I just don't think the proactive measures can be taken by the colleges, and I'll tell you about why I feel that way later. He also says there's a decrease in just tech job postings. So it's not only that the new grad coming out trying to get a job can't get a job because a dude with 10 years of experience is going to get the job first. That's kind of directly correlated to the fact that the number of jobs being posted and saying we're hiring people to do this stuff has declined in the last 4 years. By 30%. And what that means is the employer doesn't have to take the entry-level person. They can get somebody with real experience for the jobs that are still there. Approximately 137,000 tech jobs have been cut since January this year. There's 137,000 less technology jobs in the United States. Learn to code, bro? How's that working out, huh? When it comes down to it, too, the current job market challenges are that there's been this long-held belief that a college degree guarantees employment, and this belief that, if nothing else, employers value your degree. Well, that's turning out not to be the case. Employers are valuing degrees less and what the person can actually do more, and the reason is very simple. We have a surplus of people with degrees. We've made degrees very cheap to acquire and very expensive to afford at the same time. I can go to college for no money down for 4 years, 5 years, 6 years before I pay a dime on my student loans. And then when I first start making my student loan payments, I'm paying like $80 a month for something I bought 5 years ago. But the problem is that number keeps going up, and until it really goes up, the number you owe doesn't go down at all. It keeps going up too. So we're destroying the value of degrees by having too many people with them, making college way too expensive due to the low cost of entry, but not the low cost of actual ownership and acquisition of a degree. Okay? Rising student debt concerns. Because of all this, graduates are facing student debt without the assurance of employment to manage it. Broader economic implications here as well are that employment struggles of graduates may have wider effects on the economy and social structures. Meaning when you have a whole bunch of people that owe a whole bunch of money that can't get a job, it is a dead weight on the entire economy. We right now have plenty of jobs. We don't have people willing to or qualified to do them. If you're willing to bust your ass right now, you can get a job. people with no skills whatsoever, you might have to work for it, but you can probably find a job like as an apprentice in a pipe fitting job. Something like that. Or, you know, with 6 months of training, getting into the world of welding and fabrication. But people don't want to do those jobs. We've convinced, especially young men, that like that's beneath you. Any young man that comes out of anything approaching an affluent family right now is expected to go to college. It doesn't matter that people are 6 months with 6 months of training and 6 months of experience knocking back $80,000 to $100,000 out in the oil fields right now welding. That doesn't matter. It's not about how much money they make. Parents want to tell their friends that they have a transgendered child and somebody with a bunch of initials after their name as children. That's still stuck in people's mind. But when we keep doing that, we're going to end up in a situation where that entire group of people is a dead weight on the whole economy. They can't do anything and they can't get a job. Because they really can't do anything, or they can't do something that a computer can do better. And there's part of that in this, and I'll get to it in a second. But this guy, I will tell you, he has a better understanding than most people inside the system, but I don't think he totally gets it. But what he says we need is a systemic change. He wants to address the evolving job market and support future graduates in that we need to make sure that our programs are more in line with what people actually want to hire. The problem is what people actually want to hire do not require someone spending $40,000 or $50,000 a year for 4 years to attain it. So you can't fix the system that you're in because the system that you're in is the problem because the purpose of the system is what it does, is what I'm saying. And he says there's an urgent need for stakeholders, right? That would be alumni and people with money to address these employment challenges and ensure the well-being of future graduates. See, the problem is switched on as this guy seems to be. He's got to defend his house, and his house is college. His whole life is built on being a professor and the well-being of future graduates. The well-being of future graduates could be assured by having a lot less of them. There's too many of them. There are only so many things that actually require this type of education to make the person proficient in them sufficient to begin a career. I mean, think about it. You don't go to college and then go get a job at a high level, right? You know, there used to be the concept that, like, well, if you want to be a manager, right, like a middle manager in corporate America, you need a degree. But it used to also be understood by all the special little children going to get the degree that when they graduated, they're probably going to be, like, schlepping coffee and being somebody's bitch for 6 months, all right? Like, they understood that was part of, you know, paying your dues. Well, now they think they're going to go out and get a job as, like, a top-level person just because they have a degree. Well, everybody else in that company has a degree, right down to, like, probably the people that don't have a degree are the ones that empty the trash cans at night. That's about it. So you're going to be the bottom bitch in a best-case scenario. But the problem is that to do that, you don't need a degree. Now, we might have created this artificial environment where, like, it looks like you do, but you don't. You don't have to have a college degree to start out as, like, a tech support person for me or to start out as a customer service rep, even in a company that actively promotes from within, and maybe in 5 years you are that manager. You know, maybe you're in product development or something like that by then. I don't know, but, like, there's a pathway there. But you don't need 4 years of being taught all kinds of random crap on top of the core things that you do need to know to do that. And this is all beginning to just simply show what it always was, a facade. Up until about the 1970s, almost no one in America paid to go to college. This is something that's been hidden from you. It's been lied about. You don't know it. Okay? Now, in the 1940s, we got something called the GI Bill and Army College Fund. And it was a good thing that got leveraged to become a bad thing. So we had all these GIs come home, and they all had some money to go to school with. So they didn't need the old way that you got into school, which was almost everybody went to college up until that time, was paid for with alumni money through scholarship. If you were a really good student and you got into college, you probably had the money to go there. Or you could buy your way in if you were affluent. But that was the majority of students in this country. By the 1970s, this idea that the everyday guy that have otherwise been blue collar could go to college had kind of been cracked. And that was a good thing. The problem was no one had the money to go. If you wanted to send your kids to school and they weren't good enough to get that alumni money, and as more and more people wanted to go, there was too many versus the alumni money pool, the scholarship money pool, you had to pay out of pocket. So why not finance it? So student loans were introduced, and along with the greatest marketing campaign ever unleashed on behalf of private business by the American government, other than vaccines. Every child should go to college. With 45 years to 50 years of this behind us now, we're seeing the inevitable results. We subsidize something, and when we do that, the cost of it always goes up. Okay? And the amount of it always goes up. So we've made something become less valuable and more expensive at the same time. It is as simple as that. Now, the other side of it. But why can't a person find a job who has a degree in computer science from a top university with a 4.0 GPA? Do I think that graduate is incapable of being a good employee? I don't. I think they would make a great employee, especially if I have something for them to do. But do I need them? I'm sitting here right now as I record this looking at a software suite called Sony Vegas. It's been around forever. I learned how to use it back in early 2000s. It's really a video editing suite, but you can do audio with it. And since I learned video with it, I do my audio with it. And when I met a guy named Kelly, back when I first kind of started all this stuff, he looked at that suite and he said, let me show you that one filter thing right there, that one thing that one button does. Back when I was doing this in the 80s, when I got started in video editing, the piece of equipment that did that one thing was $50,000. You don't realize how lucky you are to have this technology at your fingertips. Well, that just keeps going, doesn't it? And what we've gotten to now with things like AI is that a lot of that work that coders did, we don't need coders for it anymore. Or we only need the experienced coder to take the base code and expand it. We don't need the low-end coder that we used to give a starting position to anymore, because the experienced coder can throw it at ChatGPT or what have you, and it can lay down the base code and flip it right back to them, and it can do it in minutes instead of a week or two. So there's just less jobs, and this is going to continue. If your job can be done sitting behind a computer, then a computer can do your job. And I know you're thinking, no, it can't. And maybe it can't yet. But remember what I just said, like, if I had need of that person, then I would hire someone to do that job. And a candidate out of this guy's program would probably be great if I needed, you know, computer programming, right? Or application development or something like that. But, you know, you would think, well, couldn't you use like a good audio video editor? No, because the tools are so easy to use that you could take a day to teach yourself, and I can literally edit my own material faster than I could deliver it and get it back from someone to do it for me. So I'm not going to hire somebody that's unneeded, or if I did need to hire somebody, I wouldn't hire like a professional audio video person. I'd hire a 15-year-old kid like my grandson, sit him down and give him 2 days worth of training and pay him piecework. If I needed to have somebody doing it for me, that's what I would do. I don't want a degreed professional for this. I don't even want somebody who went to audio video school or whatever. I just want somebody that can fucking do it. Now take that across like thousands of jobs. And when I say jobs, I don't mean individual jobs. I mean like types of jobs. You are actually probably more job secure right now if you sweep the hallways in a company than sit behind a desk. And yes, I know we're going to have robots that sweep hallways, but the guy that sweeps the hallway is a form of security for the building as well, and he's cheap. The guy that sits at the desk, he's expensive. Who will I automate away first? Julio that empties the garbage cans? Or Bill, who costs me $400,000 a year all in? Julio costs me $50,000 a year. Bob costs me $400,000 a year when I pay his insurance and all of that other crap, his $200 salary, his bonuses. If I can automate Bob away, I'll get rid of him. And I might even keep Bob. But if Bob has a team of 10 and I can use technology where Bob can do it with no one or one, 10 or 9 people are gone. And we keep using this very expensive, very outdated, very ineffective, very inefficient system we call college to create people to go do that, and the place we're sending them to is shrinking while their numbers are expanding. It won't get any better. Please don't think that it will and lull yourself back to sleep. We are going to have to get very innovative to adapt an economy in this age to deal with this shift that I've only been telling you is coming for over a decade now. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Again, remember, next week, all rewatch. Tomorrow, Friday, flashback. I will throw out one last call, though. If you want to support this show, you want to make sure I'm always here. I always come back from weeks of rewinds and actually start up and do it again and all. Best way to do that, join the MSB. That is the Survival Podcast Member Support Brigade. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on members to learn more, and go ahead and sign up. And with that, I will catch you guys, in about a week. In a few days. But again, remember, we will have live streaming of all the presentations from TSP 24.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.